This is the BBC.
Hey, I'm Sadia.
And I'm Monty.
Just before you get to Comedy of the Week, we wanted to introduce our brand new podcast.
No Country for Young Women.
AKA How to Be Asian or Black in a White World.
We've not really figured it out ourselves, to be honest. Maybe you could help us.
Join us.
Or pray for us, because I think we'll need both.
Yep. So that's No Country for Young Women. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, my friend. Welcome to the Comedy of the Week podcast, the home of stupendously excellent comedy from BBC Radio 4. And, well, here's another one.
Hello, I'm Lucy Porter. Within the last 6 years, I've had two children and lost both parents. So I recently became a middle-aged orphan. I felt like Oliver Twist, only instead of gruel, I wanted more Prosecco and Gogglebox. And like Oliver Twist, I fell in with a bad crowd, became a professional pickpocket, and was eventually taken in by a kindly older gentleman. My husband was livid. I started to think a lot about my relationship with the concept of family. If you're lucky, your family is a really great support network, a collection of people who will help you with anything you set out to do and always have your back. Unfortunately, none of my family could be here tonight. They all had pitiful excuses like, I'm busy, or I live in Ireland, or I'm only five and I have to go to school in the morning. Or, I'm not actually a member of your family, I'm Antonio Banderas. Please stop contacting me as per the conditions of the restraining order. Even my own husband couldn't make it. My husband, Justin, is a giant of the acting world, by which I mean he's 6'5" and he's been in Holby City. He said he had to stay in tonight because he's waiting for a call from the RSC. Not, as I thought, the Royal Shakespeare Company, but 1980s hip-hop collective, the Rocksteady Crew. Apparently Normski's put his back out and they need a hype man for a gig next week in Rill. The Radio 4 audience not familiar with the concept of the hype man. Oh, so instead, to help me tell my story, I'm joined live tonight by someone who is practically family. It's the wonderful Luke Kempner! I first met Luke when he was 8 years old, and look at him now, all grown up. Oh. Luke, how's your mum?
Oh, yeah, she's still not talking to you. And she's asked if she can have her slow cooker back.
Luke's here to help me with my mission tonight, which is to talk about the joy, despair and general weirdness that is family life. I was raised in a nuclear family. If you start Googling nuclear family, it comes in the drop-down list just before nuclear fallout. And possibly with good reason. Both will keep you indoors a lot, eating cheap tinned food, and eventually both will kill you. A nuclear family used to mean a heterosexual married couple with 2.4 children. But these days, the term is extended to a variety of two-parent families, including step-parents, adoptive parents, same-sex parents. The birds and the bees talk is now a lot more complex.
When a mummy and a daddy love each other very much, they have a special cuddle. And, well, sometimes the daddy puts a baby in the mummy's tummy. Sometimes a mummy and a daddy go to a doctor and they take an egg out of mummy and the daddy gives a special cuddle to a cup. Sometimes a daddy and a daddy love each other very much, so they give a lady money so that she'll give a special cuddle to a turkey baster. Sometimes the mummy and the daddy don't love each other, they just met at a nightclub and didn't take precautions or one another's phone numbers when they had a special cuddle behind the bottle bank in the big Asda car park.
The only time you ever see a really traditional nuclear family these days is in adverts or on Peppa Pig. And even Peppa Pig's nothing like a real-life family because they've got two preschool children and yet they're never seen watching Peppa Pig. So let's start telling my family story.
The beginning.
Let me take you back to the 1970s, where my story begins in Croydon. I'll just get Luke to paint a picture for our overseas listeners.
Croydon, a sun-drenched medieval fishing village, widely regarded as the jewel in the crown of South London. Notable residents have included Dame Peggy Ashcroft and Stormzy. Local delicacies include chicken and bread.
Some years previously, my mum and dad, Morris and Rita, had decided to leave their own families and settle down in Croydon. If this was TV, I'd probably show you a picture of my parents, but being radio, I wanted to find something you could hear. One thing about growing up in the last century was that our childhoods weren't particularly well documented. We didn't make videos or take many photos. The camera only came out on holiday, and even then you only had 12 shots, most of which my dad used to take pictures of sunsets, seabirds, and that nice couple from Ormskirk we sat next to on the plane. So the only early recording of my parents I could find was this cassette tape of me playing the piano and my dad singing along. I think you'll agree, it's quite delightful.
Holy child, how still you lie, safe the manger, soft the hay, faint upon the...
I thought you are such a nice bunch of people. You just kind of sat there kind of going, does she know it's awful? God bless him. My dad believed he was musical, in the same way that I believe I'm a tall, willowy blonde who lives in the south of France. My dad always claimed to have written the song Mull of Kintyre. Apparently, he was working in a shop in Liverpool and Paul McCartney came in while my dad was humming a tune he'd made up. Imagine my dad's surprise when some years later he heard that very tune at number one in the hit parade. It's a good job Macca didn't nick my dad's words for the lyrics too. It wouldn't have been quite so wistful if it had gone like this.
Two tins of peas, that's 55p, mate. Have you got the five? 'Cause I'm low on silvers. No worries, next, please.
Little extra information for you. Luke had to listen to Mull of Kintyre because he'd never heard it. Look, yeah. Have you got a treat when the frog chorus comes your way? As you might have been able to tell from the clip, my dad was from Northern Ireland. This alerted me to the idea that all families are different. Other kids at school used to tease me, saying,
your dad's in the IRA! Your dad's in the IRA!
And I would reply very confidently, no, you're wrong. My granddad's in the IRA. Actually, my granddad was in the RUC, the Northern Irish Police Force, but I didn't understand when I was a kid because there were loads of acronyms connected to the Troubles.
These included the IRA, the RUC, the UDF, the UVF and the OMG. That was the IRA's drag queen wing. They had really stunning balaclavas.
And to complicate matters even further, my dad's family was Catholic, and being Catholic in the RUC was like being a cat in a team of huskies, or like being the only vampire member of the Crucifix and Stake Whittlers Union. On my mum's side, there was great-uncle Billy, who was a builder. The legendary story about him was that he'd had a very successful construction business until he started drinking. Eventually, things got so bad that his wife left him, his children didn't speak to him, and he was living in his van. That was all he owned, his van and his ladders. One day, he hit rock bottom and he was down to his last few pennies. He went to the local pub and spent the remainder of his money on one final pint. He didn't know what he was going to do next, and as he drained his pint glass and put it down on the table, a shaft of sunlight came through the pub window. And this shaft of sunlight passed through the cross on the spire of the church outside and projected the perfect image of the cross onto the table in front of him. And Uncle Billy saw the cross and made a decision. He went back, got his van and his ladders, and went up on the church roof and nicked the lead. He sold it, came back and bought a round for everyone in the pub. That's my family, drunk but generous. Apart from that, I thought my immediate family was pretty dull, save the fact that my dad wrote Mull of Kintyre. And I'm ashamed to say that once I hit my teens, I was just desperate to get out of suburbia. This took me to the next stage of my journey through family life.
Leaving the nest.
A lot of people spend their 20s away from their old family units, trying to start anew and make a sort of family out of friends, romantic partners and housemates. I left home in the 1990s when the TV show Friends was a template for our generation and we thought it was really cool. But even the friends in Friends had a definite mum figure in Monica, and Chandler was a sort of silly dad. Rachel, Joey and Phoebe were the kooky kids, and Ross was the uncle that nobody likes.
Hey, who likes dinosaurs? I like dinosaurs. Let me tell you my top 100 dinosaur facts after I've told you about the misery of my last divorce.
Is that one of your impressions?
Yes.
Very good. Who was it meant to be?
It was Ross from Friends. Thank you. One person.
That's your mum. When you start moving away from the family unit you grew up in and replacing them with friends, it's an important moment because that's when you realise just how weird your own family was. For example, my mum was such a fan of not making a fuss that when we went out to a restaurant as a family, we all had to order exactly the same thing in order to make it easier for the waiter. It was awful as well, because frankly, when you're an eight-year-old girl, you don't always fancy a fillet steak and a bottle of Rioja. And when you share flats with people, you realise that all families have their own quirks and foibles, and in a flat share, you bring them all together.
What do you mean we're not bringing out a tiny sock for the goldfish? It's Christmas!
What do you mean, why am I putting the bread in the fridge? That's where it goes!
What do you mean we're not putting a tiny plastic rabbit in the goldfish bowl? It's Easter!
And then you start dating. In my case, I met a very tall, posh actor called Justin, and we became friends, and then one day we had a surprise sleepover. Some wine had been taken, if I'm honest, that night. And then we became more than friends. Then we ended up having more surprise sleepovers, getting frankly less surprising all the time. And then eventually we got married, and even more eventually, this led to the next stage of my journey.
Starting our own family.
When I got pregnant, I decided to buy a load of magazines to let me know what to expect. But the pregnancy magazines did my head in. There were adverts for lacy lingerie with the slogan,
"We're proving you can be pregnant and sexy."
I don't want to be pregnant and sexy. I feel my obligation to sexiness has been served. Surely the massive pregnant belly is Mother Nature's way of saying, "Move along, fellas, this one's been done." And I remember reading about mumtrepreneurs. The article said stuff like,
"Once you've had your baby and you're on maternity leave, you might have a great idea for a new product and want to start your own business."
And when I was pregnant, I thought, yes, I bet I will totally do that. Then I had the baby and, oh my God, start my own business. I didn't even brush my hair for the first 6 months. Show me a successful mumtrepreneur and I'll show you a baby that's only nice and quiet because it's already on the gin. I hate the word mumtrepreneur. A journalist wrote an article in which he called me a mummedian. I know, I was so angry. I wanted to kill him. I didn't, mainly because the press would have described me as a mumderer. I decided to try hypnotherapy before I gave birth the first time. I paid this guy £300 for a number of sessions. He told me that when I felt my first contraction, I should picture a blue balloon. And as the contractions got more intense, I should imagine the blue balloon expanding. And then when I thought I couldn't take the pain anymore, I should just imagine the blue balloon floating away and surrender myself to a higher power. So my first contraction started and I imagined £300 floating away as I surrendered myself to the higher power of an epidural. Once I'd had the baby, things didn't get much easier. The problem with being a new mum is you're so isolated. You end up joining all kinds of classes just to get out of the house and meet people. I did baby swimming. God, that was miserable. They say,
"Oh, babies have a natural ability to swim. They remember being in the womb."
Well, maybe, but I'm not sure being in the womb is exactly like being in a freezing municipal swimming pool in January. Even my womb didn't have sticking plasters floating about in it. Then there was baby massage. That's fine when they're really little and stay still, but when they start crawling, basically you've greased up your baby. It's trying to get away from you. It's basically like trying to catch a wet bar of soap. They should make it an Olympic sport. Justin and I practice a style of parenting called benign neglect. It's the middle class version of neglect. I'm not sure that your style of parenting even matters that much anyway. When we potty trained our first child, it went really well, and I considered myself something of an expert. Then it came to our second, and, well, let's just say it was a slightly messier business. There was an incident in the RAF Museum in Hendon that could have been perceived as a grave insult to the British Armed Forces.
Personally, I don't know why everyone makes such a big deal out of parenting these days. It seems simple to me. Just set definite boundaries for your children, explain clearly what you expect from them, and be gentle but firm if they misbehave.
Luke, who are you to give parenting advice? Do you remember when you babysat my children?
Oh, hi, Luke. Hi, Luke. Thanks so much for stepping in to look after the kids. Is everything going okay?
Yeah, great. Oh, just one thing. Are they allowed cigars?
No, of course they're not allowed cigars.
Oh, no, just kidding. Put that out right now.
Luke, are you sure you're okay?
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, we just...
Mummy, we've been watching Game of Thrones.
Listen, Lucy, I don't mean to be rude, but your children are very mean drunks.
Luke!
Found that for all the magazines and guides out there, there are only a few pieces of parenting advice that you really need.
One, you will need many, many incredibly specific dressing up outfits.
Instead of doing my NCT childbirth course, I wish I'd taken a crash course in theatrical dressmaking. That would have prepared me for the obscure Roald Dahl minor characters and historically accurate Viking costumes I'm expected to produce with under 48 hours notice. Yes, I know Viking helmets didn't really have horns on them, but the ones you can buy on eBay do, okay?
Two, don't worry too much about your kids hearing swear words at school or on telly.
Better to have them do that than have to explain what all those words were that Mummy called the BMW that cut her up on the roundabout.
Three, sleepovers are a universally recognised barter system amongst parents.
Host as many children as you can in one go. It will be hell and none of you will get a wink of sleep, but you will maximise the number of child-free nights other parents now owe you.
Four, you will always need to have £1 coin handy per child. The pound coins may be desperately needed at any given moment.
That is so true and so important. All you hear once you have kids is this.
Mum, it's comic relief on Friday and I have to bring in a pound. Mum, it's World Nature Day on Tuesday and I have to bring in a pound. Mum, we're sponsoring our teacher to see if she can go a whole day without crying. I need to bring in a pound. Mum, have you got a pound? Mummy, I need a pound. Mum, have you got a pound?
Mummy, I need a pound.
Mum, can I have a pound?
Please, Mum.
Have a pound.
I've got a pound.
I need a pound.
A pound.
That is my real children. And I've sort of just said, oh, look, just read these funny little things out. And then they read the one and my son went, does my teacher really cry every day? So we move on to the next phase of the family, which is...
siblings.
Our children were like buses. We tried for ages to have the first one and then the second one came along really quickly. And they're both massive and red. Our children are so close in age that someone told me they were what's known as Irish twins. Not a phrase I care for myself. I think it's a bit racist and in the light of Jedward, it's bloody terrifying. Although I'm pleased to say that my children, John and Emily, or Gemily, are delightful. There's a suggestion that families will often have two kids because the parents want to replace themselves in a new generation. I say it's because they get a Vauxhall Astra and then they feel like if they don't fill it properly, it'll be a waste. A study from the London School of Economics did find that parents with two children are the happiest, but that crucially, that happiness spike comes in the run-up to the birth of the second child. After the kid's been born, their happiness levels go back down again. Parents like the idea of two children, not the shouty, sticky, expensive reality. But never mind the parents, what about the effect of family size on children? I decided to get the lowdown from a professional, and luckily, one of my very own sisters is a child psychologist. I wanted to ask her whether having brothers and sisters is a broadly positive thing. Surely having siblings makes you a more thoughtful and caring person, more aware of the needs and feelings of others.
So, Mary, as a psychologist...
Lucy, I'm not a psychologist, I'm a psychiatrist.
No, right. Are they different things?
Yeah. I've got nothing to do with child psychology. I'm a specialist in addictive behaviour.
Are you? Really? Well, why did I not know that?
Because you never asked.
But I did.
No, you didn't.
I'm sure I did. You've just never forgiven me for stealing your She-Ra Princess of Power doll.
Was that you?
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, technically
you,
it was sort of half mine anyway,
it?
Wasn't it?
But can I have it back?
No, it's mine now.
Oh, my God. Oh, I hate you.
Oh, shut up.
Oh, God,
you're
that's it. I'm
so...
going to my room.
All right, go to your room. I don't care.
So the jury's still out. When it comes down to it, sharing your childhood and your parents is the ultimate con and the ultimate pro to having a sibling. For every frayed hand-me-down and cramped bunk bed, there's a moment where you have someone to roll your eyes at in exasperation when your parents start singing along to Cat Stevens with the windows down in a traffic jam. Or claiming they wrote Mull of Kintyre. In my experience, having siblings can be handy when you enter the final phase of the nuclear family, the bit where you have to pull together, step up and start helping your parents. I've called this final section...
Parenting Your Own Parents.
Because it does feel like the world turns on its head and suddenly your parents are asking you to help them and they really need you, just like you needed them when you were a kid. And everyone is terrified. As the child, you're terrified that you won't be able to adequately repay all the love and care your parents gave to you. And your parents are terrified because they know that their children are massive idiots. Never truer than in my case. It really never is. When you're parenting small children, it's fine because they don't know any better and you can smooth over life's rougher edges. It's fine to tell your kids that the reason the hamster's not here anymore is because it's gone to live on a lovely farm. You can't tell your dad the same thing about Jeff from the darts club. I didn't even properly realise my parents were old until they started getting ill. If you're lucky enough to have parents who live to an old age, there's bound to be something wrong with them eventually. You become an expert in ailments, diseases and syndromes. At one point, Dad had COPD, AMD, AF, RA and a UTI. He thought he was back in Belfast during the Troubles. Dad suffered for years with lung disease and Mum eventually succumbed to dementia. And the crisis in the social care system really shocked me. There are loads of amazing, brilliant, dedicated professionals trying to do their best for older people, but there's just no money to support it. And I think we don't make enough of a fuss about it because we don't really value the elderly enough. I consider myself a pretty right-on person, but I'd never given ageism much thought. Unlike a lot of the other isms, sexism, racism, ableism, with ageism, you will almost certainly one day become the thing you have mocked. It's like Donald Trump waking up tomorrow as a Mexican gay, disabled, lesbian, Muslim woman. And that is something I, for one, would pay good money to see.
Hola, soy Donald Trump. Salam alaikum. Black lives matter. Gun control now. Oh God, what am I saying? Hashtag me too.
Bloody good, isn't it? It's bloody amazing that you can do that. So clever. He's a credit, isn't he? A credit to his parents, though. He really is. You know, his sister's lovely as well. She's a very talented family. Well done. I mean, he's scruffy, though. Here are some lessons I learned in my parents' final years.
1. Remember how much you resented it as a child when your parents patronised you. This is your chance to get your own back.
Well, I don't care if Jean's children let her drive on her own at night. When you're in our house, you'll abide by our rules.
2. Not all old people are nice.
Some of them are curmudgeonly old whingers.
3. If you're a nice old person, everyone patronises or ignores you.
It's actually much better to be a curmudgeonly old whinger. People do what you want just to get rid of you.
4. Be prepared to hear too much information.
When we were looking after my mum, it was like someone had locked her in a confessional booth and said she could only come out once she had no secrets left. The upside was I got to know my mum in all the detail she would never let me see when she was younger. The downside was I got to know my mum in all the detail she would never let me see when she was younger.
Five. There are loads of interesting activities for seniors in most areas of the UK.
Although, if your parents are anything like mine, they'd rather just go to Morrison's Cafe and sit with other old people comparing their symptoms. I was all, oh, look, Mum, mixed martial arts for the visually impaired. Hip replacement capoeira. Body popping with osteoporosis. And she was like, yeah, but Morrison's serve cake.
Six. When you have children under five, you will spend a lot of time in soft play centres. When you have parents over 80, you will spend a lot of time in garden centres.
If you have both children under five and parents over 80, it is possible that on any given day you will be dropping two different generations at two completely different types of nursery.
Seven. Get used to singing.
From ages 5 to 95, it's amazing what wonders can be worked by a sing-along. Just make sure you consider your audience. Nothing will confuse your 5-year-old more than a rousing rendition of We'll Meet Again, while no 80-year-old wants to be serenaded with the theme tune to Paw Patrol.
Eight. Carry lots of pound coins.
You'll need a pound coin for the trolley at Morrison's, a pound coin for parking outside the doctor's surgery, a pound coin for the voluntary tea and coffee contribution at the community centre, and of course a pound coin to toss to see if you or your husband gets the day off. So now you've always got to carry a pound for each of your children and a pound for each of your parents.
Nine. Remember, you're not actually your parents' parents.
When you're looking after kids, you want to raise them right and discourage any bad habits. But if your mum has made it to her 80s, she has earned the right to have all the bad habits she wants. Let her smoke indoors. Let her eat only cake from the Morrison's Cafe. Let her join a Satan-worshipping motorcycle gang if she wants to. She spent her whole life doing the right thing, and now she's stuck with her slightly patronising daughter measuring her blood pressure and cholesterol. It can be hard for both of you, so why not have fun? In hindsight, at least my parents lived to see old age, and at least my sisters and I got to spend a lot of time with them in the final years of their lives, even though I think we'd all rather so much of it hadn't been in A&E departments and Morrison's Cafe. So that's the story of my family. The cycle is complete, but of course, by starting my own family, I've left the way open for a sequel. It's very much the circle of life.
It's the circle of life!
Don't encourage him. It's late, he's tired, and he's showing off. So I'll leave you with one final tip. If you do still have parents, try to make some recordings of their voices because they're lovely to have. The only record I've got of my mum's voice are the last answer phone messages she left me. And she had dementia by then and she could never remember why she'd phoned me. So she had to keep going, hang on a minute. No, it'll come back to me. So at least the messages are nice and long. But I did actually get my dad to record a message for the kids before he died. And so I won't say goodbye. I'll leave that to my dad.
Have a lovely time and enjoy it. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much indeed.
Holy child, how still you lie.
Lucy Porter in The Family Way was written by Lucy Porter with additional material by Gabby Hutchinson Crouch. It starred Lucy Porter, her family and Luke Kempner. It was directed by Gordon Kennedy and produced by Marilyn Imrie and Gordon Kennedy, and it's an Absolutely production for the BBC.
Oh no, we're at the end of this episode of Comedy of the Week. What to do, what to do? Well, here's an idea. You could go listen to more episodes of this series at bbc.co.uk/radio4. I mean, it's not like I want to force you. Okay, I completely am telling you to do it. Just go do it. You will not regret it. You will thank me. You don't even know me, and you'll thank me. Okay, great. Wonderful. Until next time, bye.
Death in Ice Valley.
A major new podcast series.
She was laying with her head down there. And her legs up here.
A woman's unidentified body. A 47-year-old mystery. Our investigation.
Search for Death in Ice Valley wherever you find your podcasts.